Second canto, Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter 7, entitled Scheduled Incarnations with Specific Functions. And today we read in text 9. Please kindly repeat responsibly. Yadvenam, sorry. Yadvenam utpatagatam vijavakya vajra.
Yadvenam utpatagatam vijavakya vajra.
One more time. Yadvenam utpatagatam vijavakya vajra.
Yadvenam utpatagatam vijavakya vajra.
Nishplushta Paurusha Bhagam Niraya Patantam.
Nishplushta Paurusha Bhagam Niraya
Patantam. Tratvartito Jagati Putra Padam Chalebhe. Tratvartito Jagati Putra Padam Chalebhe. Dugdha Vasuni Vasudha Sakalani Henam. Dugdha Vasuni Vasudha Sakalani Henam.
Dugdha Vasuni Vasudha Sakalani
Venam utpatagatam vijavakya vajra. Nishplushta paurusha bhagam niraya patantam. Tratvartito jagati putra padam chalebhe. Dugdava suni vasudha sakalani ena.
Dugdava
suni vasudha sakalani utpada katam divja vakya vajra.
Yadvenam utpada katam divja vakya vajra.
Nishplashta paurasa bhagam niraye patantam. Tratvartito jagati putra padam chalebe. Dukta vasuni vasudha sakattani yena.
Patagatam Dijavakya Bajra. Nishplushta Paurusha Bhagam Niraye Patantam. Tratvartito Jagati Putra Padam Chalebe.
Vaishnavis.
Vena,
Vena,
unto King Vena,
Vena.
Utpatagatam,
Utpatagatam,
going astray
from
the righteous path,
from the righteous path.
Vija,
Vija,
of the Brahmanas,
Vakya,
words of cursing,
words of cursing.
Vajra,
Vajra,
thunderbolt,
thunderbolt.
Nishplushta,
Nishplushta,
being burned by,
being burned by.
Paurusha,
Paurusha,
great deeds,
great deeds.
Bhagam, opulence,
opulence.
Niraye,
Niraye,
into hell,
into hell.
Patanta,
Patanta,
going down,
going down.
Tratva,
Tratva,
by delivering,
by delivering.
Artita,
Artita,
so being prayed for,
so being prayed for.
Jagati,
Jagati,
on the world,
on the world.
Putrapadam,
Putrapadam,
the position of the sun,
the position of the sun.
Cha,
Cha,
as well
as
Lebhe,
Lebhe,
achieved,
achieved.
Dugda,
Dugda,
exploited,
exploited.
Vasuni,
Vasuni,
produce,
produce.
Vasudha,
Vasudha,
the earth,
the earth.
Sakalani,
Sakalani,
all kinds of,
all kinds of.
Yena,
Yena,
by whom,
by whom.
Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, His Confounder Acharya Abhay Charanaravinda Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Maharaj Vena went astray from the path of righteousness, and the Brahmanas chastised him by the thunderbolt curse. By this, King Vena was burned with his good deeds and opulence, and was en route to hell. The Lord, by His causeless mercy, descended as His Son, by the name of Prithu, delivered the contaminated King Vena from hell, and exploited the earth by drawing all kinds of crops as produce. Srila Prabhupada's purport. According to the system of Varnashram Dharma, the pious and learned Brahmanas were the natural guardians of society. The Brahmanas, by their learned labor of love, would instruct the administrator kings how to rule the country in complete righteousness. And thus the process would go on as a perfect welfare state. The kings or the Kshatriya administrators would always consult the council of learned Brahmanas. They were never autocratic monarchs. The scriptures like Manu Samhita and other authorized books of the great sages were guiding principles for ruling the subjects. And there was no need for less intelligent persons to manufacture a code of law in the name of democracy. The less intelligent mass of people have very little knowledge of their own welfare. As a child has very little knowledge of its future well-being. The experienced father guides the innocent child towards the path of progress, and the childlike mass of people need similar guidance. The standard welfare codes are already there in the Manu Samhita and other Vedic literatures. The learned Brahmanas would advise the king in terms of those standard books of knowledge and with reference to the particular situation of time and place. Such Brahmanas were not paid servants of the king, and therefore they had the strength to dictate to the king on the principles of scriptures. This system continued even up to the time of Maharaj Chandragupta, and the Brahmana Chanakya was his unpaid prime minister. Maharaj Vena did not adhere to the principle of ruling, and he disobeyed the learned Brahmanas. Maharaj Vena did not adhere to this principle of ruling, and he disobeyed the learned Brahmanas. The broad-minded Brahmanas were not self-interested, but looked to the interest of complete welfare for all the subjects. They wanted to chastise King Vena for his misconduct and so prayed to the Almighty Lord as well as cursed the king. Long life, obedience, good reputation, righteousness, prospects of being promoted to higher planets and blessings of great personalities are all vanquished simply by disobedience to a great soul. One should strictly try to follow in the footsteps of great souls. Maharaj Vena became a king, undoubtedly due to his past deeds of righteousness, but because he was willfully neglected the great souls, he was punished by the loss of all the above mentioned acquisitions. In the Vamana Purana, the history of Maharaj Vena and his degradation are fully described. When Maharaj Prithu heard about the hellish condition of his father, Vena, who was suffering from leprosy in the family of Mlechas, he at once brought the former king to Kurukshetra for his purification and relieved him from all sufferings. Maharaj Prithu, the incarnation of God, descended by the prayer of the Brahmanas to rectify the disorders on earth. He produced all kinds of crops, but at the same time he performed the duty of a son who delivers his father from hellish conditions. The word Putra means one who delivers from hell, called Put. That is a worthy son. So with the blessings and the permission of the seniors in this audience, I would like to proceed further and try to humbly elaborate on what has been presented by Srila Prabhupada. My notebook remained in the second canto there. It should be inside. Dear devotees, we're discussing the scheduled incarnations of the Lord, and here today we're particularly dealing with the incarnation of Prithu Maharaj. And everything is in the context. Yeah, thank you. I don't need the book, I just need that. Thank you very much. Everything is in the context of, particularly this verse, in the context of his father, Maharaj Vena. Now, a little bit of a background. Who is this Maharaj Vena that strayed away from the path of righteousness and the Brahmins chastised him by the thunderbolt curse? He was basically... like it's explained, he went to hell for his activities. Who is this Vena? And how come Prithu appeared in his family? So, in the fourth canto, there is a whole description of this pastime. And Maharaj Vena was a descendant of the son of Maharaj Anga. And Maharaj Anga was the son of Dhruva Maharaj. So basically there was a line of great leaders. But Maharaj Anga saw that his son Vena was very disrespectful, proud person. He saw that he was unfit to become a ruler. He did not have another son. He became extremely disturbed due to having as the son who is supposed to take over the kingdom after he retires. Maharaj Anga became extremely disturbed that his son was an unworthy son. In fact, in the fourth canto, there is a description how Maharaj Anga is saying it is better to have no son than to have a rascal son like my son Vena. And he could not take this And silently one night he just left for the forest and left the kingdom behind. He was looking after the people. He was taking care of everyone, but that gave him so much pain that his son was actually like a demonic person. Very criminal mentality. That gave him so much pain. So he left. And after Maharaj Changa left the kingdom without notifying anyone, for some time there was a commotion. And then the criminal element increased in society. So immediately people started to be abused, robbed by different thieves and crooks. When there is no king, when there is no overseer, then immediately unrighteousness starts to manifest. So what to do? Then the sages, headed by Bhrigu Muni, is a very great sage who can also travel interplanetary. There is a story how he went to Brahma, Shiva and Vishnu to see who is the Lord. So Bhrigu Muni is a very great sage. So he and some other sages, they decided to install Vena as the heir. Although he was unqualified, there was no one else. So they put Vena on the throne. But the ministers of King Anga were very disturbed. Ministers were completely disappointed. But because the sages ordered that, then they accepted the situation. So after King Vena ascended the throne, immediately the crime decreased. He chased all the criminals and he created law and order. But along with that, he became very proud. And he started to insult great souls, very advanced devotees, brahmanas. He stopped all the sacrifices in the kingdom. And he was telling the people that he is the only worthy object of worship. So why worship Vishnu? You should worship me, he was saying like that. I am the father of the nation. I am providing for you. I am protecting you from the criminals. You should worship me. So he became extremely proud. And insulted many brahmanas and devotees. So the brahmanas were seeing that King Vena in that position, he was actually dead man walking. Basically, they saw that he was living dead. And because he insulted the Lord, first of all, by saying that they should worship him and they should not perform sacrifices. So they just saw his end is coming. Vena called them, called the brahmanas unchaste because they wanted to worship the Lord. So he said, I am the father, you should worship me. This is chastity to me. Why should you worship this Vishnu who you cannot see? Maybe he doesn't even exist. That was his idea. So then the brahmanas, being faithful devotees, they realized we have to do something about it. So they gathered together, counseled one another, and decided to kill King Vena. So here it is explained that they chastised him by the thunderbolt curse. So King Vena was a very powerful kshatriya. He had a lot of physical strength and influence over the people, but he didn't know that there is higher powers than physical strength or intellectual strength. He didn't know the strength of Dharma. And the brahmanas were actually following Dharma. And that strength is much more superior power than Vena's base physical and intellectual power that he was exhibiting. So they decided to destroy him But by destroying him, they realize that there is another problem. There is no descendant to the throne again. Because Vena had no children. So what do we do then? At that time, the dynasties were kept, basically, and people didn't want, the Brahmins didn't want to disturb the dynasty. They didn't want to put someone else from outside. So the dynasties were preserved and kept in that way. So what they did, they did some, what we're going to call magic, you know, in modern society. They simply, from the arms of Vena, it says here they churned the arms of Vena. They probably took the DNA of Vena. They took a sample of his body. And then through their mystic power, they prayed to the Lord for the mercy to appear. And basically, from this mystical feat appeared first one person who was became the king of the Nishada race. He absorbed all the sinfulness, all the crooked mentality from King Vena. And that person was basically installed as the Nishada king, the king of people who had law consciousness, who had criminal consciousness or whatever. So they tried to install him there to rule these people and kind of create balance within this community of low consciousness, of people with low consciousness. And then after that, the second sample created Maharaj Prithu and his... there were two personalities that emerged from the body of Vena. That was Prithu and Archie. So then they realized that this is... according to the scheduled incarnations, they had some expectation that this could be the Lord appearing in that dynasty with his consort, Lakshmi. It's very difficult to understand these things. They're very far-fetched for our modern minds to comprehend. It's really far out. Churning someone's arm, taking the DNA and producing another person, two persons, three actually, the Nishada king and then Prithu and then Archie. And then basically creating a whole new system from that, the dead body of a king. Vena was killed. So something very difficult to understand, but if it's in Shastra, we cannot argue with this. And in fact, there is logic to it. Like I said, the Brahmins had these powers. Due to their devotion, they could summon divine intervention. Due to their devotion, they could summon divine intervention. So after the demise of Vena, then immediately again the criminal element increased because there was no king. And so Prithu appeared, and when he grew up, he became installed on the throne instead of Maharaj Vena. And Archie became his wife. Again, very inconceivable to understand. Coming from the same body of the same person, Vena, is husband and wife. Generally, you know, brother and sister don't marry, you know, in this society. So, but because this was created through the mystic power of the Brahmanas, You know, and ultimately it wasn't even, the Brahmanas were not even the cause of that, because from a transcendental point of view, the cause of all causes is Krishna. So he arranged all that so that he could appear, and there is some specific lessons that we could learn from this specific incarnation. So these are very deep things, very strange things to our modern minds. Try to listen carefully. Pay attention. Don't allow the mind to put you into samadhi. You know, hear very, very carefully. What we're going to say today is going to purify you completely. So, now, this was the arrangement of the Lord. The Brahmans were the instrument of this Prithu to appear. And Prithu was actually a partial incarnation of the Lord. It's explained in the fourth canto. And what was his service? What was his specific function? Well, the specific function was to establish Dharma. Because the king's duty is to establish Dharma. Dharma means the practice of religious principles. In this case, as you heard, the Brahmins were forbidden to perform sacrifices. So Dharma was killed by Vena. So Prithu's duty was to re-establish Dharma again on the planet. And by establishing Dharma, he could allow the living entities in human bodies to become liberated from the material world. Because the human form of life, the purpose of human form is to achieve liberation from the cycle of birth and death. Now, during Vena's rule, a lot of people became atheists, confused, and they engaged in materialistic activities, sense gratification, in karmic activities, which continued their cycle of birth and death, samsara, during Vena's rule. So, immediately Prithu's duty was to re-establish Dharma, give the opportunity of the people again to return back to the spiritual world. So he was a partial incarnation. At that time, the earth was ruled by one emperor. So in fact, this Prithu became the emperor of the whole earth. It wasn't just the emperor of India. This is not the history of India. This is the history of the whole planet. And this is about 2 million years ago, this happened. Now, according to modern history, 2 million years ago, there was probably some amoebas around or some kind of lord creatures on, you know, not really anything intelligent as human beings. You know, that's according to modern science. But according to the Srimad Bhagavatam, 2 million of years ago, there was human beings anatomically the same as today. You see. So, proof of that. Well, the proof is that, first of all, the scientists don't have the mechanism for creating the mechanism that produced different species. They cannot pinpoint what's the mechanism that produced different species. According to Darwin and modern neo-Darwinists, the initial living entity was, the first living entity was some single-celled amoeba. It's like very low type of creature, very simple creature, which was composed of chemical elements. And from that amoeba, my dear ladies and gentlemen, Darwin said that the whole life as we know it emerged. So the amoeba is the father of everyone. That's what he's saying. Now, we shouldn't laugh if we can't defeat this philosophy. So how do we understand whether Darwin was right or whether the Bhagavatam is right? Looks like the Bhagavatam is supporting Darwin's theory. How? They churned the body of Vena and took from his body the DNA and produced life. Interesting, huh? So when you read like this, you may get so confused. Wow, you know, they just churned the body and they got another person out of this body, and you know, so there is no spiritual energy, it's all matter. You just manipulate the matter and you produce life. Interesting, isn't it? So what is your answer, my dear audience? The answer is that we have to look at the scientific research and we have to look at the whole range of Vedic science to be able to come to a conclusion. And I'm not going to delve very deeply in this subject, but I will touch upon it. So from modern non-mainstream science, we understand that the mainstream science today does not have really the answers about the origin of life. For example, mainstream science, like I said, is very firmly convinced that matter is the source of all life. But non-mainstream science developed in the past perhaps 50 years. It's almost when Prabhupada started preaching that life comes from life. So this science is pinpointing that they don't have really the mechanism which leads from this so-called initial species, amoeba, to the variety of species that we find today. We see so many species out there. Every few years they find new species on the planet that they didn't know about. So many species, so many varieties of ants, so many varieties of birds, so many varieties of human beings, so many varieties of fishes there, plants, thousands and thousands and thousands. So how from this amoeba, you know, all this variety of life appeared like that? So they don't have the answer. So Darwin was saying it is through crossbreeding. He was saying that in time the environment molds the species in a certain way, the environment, the external environment, and then it develops a slightly different form or different behavior or shape. And then when that species couples with another, entity couples with another entity from the same species who is still keeping the original form, when they have a union, they produce a new species. That was Darwin's idea. It's called breeding, interbreeding. Just like if you get one type of dog and another type of dog, and if you interbreed them, you get the third type of dog, right? You've seen like that? Yes? So, that was his idea. And then he experimented with breeding. And then there were many other scientists who experimented with pigeons and dogs and plants. And they realized that they can change the shape a little, the color, but they cannot really change the species. Species means that two entities, they can unite and they can produce offspring. That means they are from the same species. Different species cannot produce offspring. So
basically they understood that you can never produce a new species from that. For example, the mule, the donkey, and the horse, when you interbreed them, it becomes a mule. You heard this? But the mule cannot actually procreate. It cannot produce offspring. Interesting. It just ends there. So many, many examples are there that show that this is a dead-end mechanism for producing the variety that we see today. Then they came up with pangenesis, Lamarck, a French scientist. His idea was that the environment and the need of the animal or the living entity, certain needs that they may have, and the environment impacts and then shapes the body, and then the body changes from one into another. For example, the horse became a giraffe because it stretched its neck. Over a period of time, it kept stretching, and then the horse's neck became too tall. And gradually, the impact of environment and then the inner drive, they call it an inner nebulous force to change. They couldn't, nebulous means something abstract. That abstract force internally, they had faith that there is some abstract force inside that changes one species into another. So then they couldn't pinpoint this. What is it? And they made a lot of experiments and they saw that it does not really work. Like, for example, in Africa, Central Africa, they put on the ladies these rings on the neck. You've seen some pictures with elongated necks, many, many rings to elongate the neck. That's considered beautiful in Africa. So this has been done by women for thousands and thousands of years. And still, the babies, if you don't put this, the neck will not be elongated. That means there is no a genetic change being passed down into the new generations that come. It basically remains the same unless you artificially do something about it. And in fact, it's completely unnatural. If you take the rings, if you cut the rings, they cannot hold their head straight. It falls like that because the neck is too long, so they cannot hold the head. So you have to lifetime, you're tied to these thin metal rings on your neck. Many, many examples like that. So this shows that pangenesis really is not the mechanism for producing the variety of species that we see today. And then they did some more research, and when the molecular biology developed some 60, 70 years ago, they started to look with the microscope into the cells, and they discovered the DNA in the 50s, I think. And later on they realized that the DNA copies itself. So when the DNA is copied, they saw that there are certain mutations that appear. Some mutations occur in the copying of the DNA. And they thought that this is probably the key to the answer, that, you know, the dilemma we are facing. So this is called neo-Darwinism. And some people think that this is it, the copying of the DNA when there is a mutation and change that produces the new species. But then when they did some research, they saw that this mutation produces only more defective organisms rather than more effective organisms. So everything becomes more and more defective. And this cannot constitute a suitable mechanism for creating new species. So they don't want to reveal this to society, because if they reveal this, that they don't have the answer, then their whole academic system is going to fail. So they're just making up all kind of philosophies and theories to present like a nice facade and cheat the ordinary public. So this is just when you look on a molecular level. But if you look on a level of archaeology, there is no evidence. In fact, there is something called the Cambrian explosion. Cambrian explosion means that the archaeologists, they found all the species as we know them today to be existing in the same layer in the earth, you know, the artifacts, the fossils of all the species that exist in today, anatomically the same as today, to have existed some millions of years ago, in this, whenever this Cambrian explosion, accordingly, they say it was a Cambrian explosion that happened some time ago, and then they found all these species existing in the same layer. So then they came up with the theory that there was a sudden change in all the species at the same time. You know, there was something else, and suddenly all of them changed into what they are today, and that's why you find them in all these layers at the same time, simultaneously. Because evolution is supposed to be unguided, accidental. Then how on earth then all these species changed at the same time, you know, and you find them in the same layer, like the fish and the human being, and you know, you find the whatever, the horse and monkey, you find everything there on that layer. So they call this punctuated equilibrium, which is some kind of total speculation. They say that the evolution on the planet, it built up, and suddenly it exploded into changing of all the living entities simultaneously. What is the proof? They don't have any proof. It's a theory. And they say, no, this is what happened. So they're preaching atheism. And because people are so simple, they can be very easily cheated. François Voltaire said, masses are docile, like sheep. You can cheat them very easy. You just tell them something, put a man with a suit and tie to speak very, elaborately on some subject. Just give them some soca and beer, and they'll believe him, you know. So this is what's going on. And I don't think I can give you a 3-4 hour lecture on this, but I want to look at this. I'm just saying all these things so that we don't think the Bhagavatam is some kind of a book of human imagination, and we misunderstand the value of Srimad Bhagavatam. So story happened 2 million years ago, the time of Prithu Maharaj. So at that time there were humans anatomically the same as today, which according to the scriptures, you know, this is the evidence, historical evidence that is there. And we hear also from archaeologists that there are human artifacts found in layers 2 million years old or even more in different places on the planet. They hide it away from. If anything, there is a knowledge filter. If anything doesn't support the Darwinian theory, they take it away. They hide it away from the public. It's called knowledge filter. For example, their theory was that there was the African Eve. They thought that the first human being appeared in Africa. And they calculated they studied the closeness of different cultures on the planet, in terms of their DNA structure and so on and so forth, different cultures. So they use computers to calculate. And so the scientists who did the first experiment, they came with the conclusion that this is the African Eve. Basically, the first human beings were in Africa. Then they rerun the same experiment with different computers at different times, and then became the Chinese first, and then something else, some other culture, you know, appeared to be the first. But then they don't say this, you know. And another evidence is the first human being, the way we know it today, Homo sapiens, accordingly appeared, according to modern science, appeared 100,000 years ago. But then they found in America, this lady Virginia McIntyre, she found human artifacts in Mexico, 300,000 years old. So how can that be? You know, if the first human being, Homo sapiens, evolved from whatever, Homo erectus or whatever it was before, how can that be that you find human artifacts in Mexico if the first human being appeared in Africa 100,000 years ago? So then they immediately dismissed, they chased her, they took a position, they kicked her out of the academic world. There is interviews on the internet with her. And then Druta Karma Prabhu, Michael Krimo, Prabhupada's disciple, they found some scientists, archaeologists, they found some coins in America, I don't know how many hundreds and thousands of years old, with the human face on the coin, basically engraved. So they had even coins at that time, hundreds and thousands of years ago, you know, 200,000 or 300,000 years ago. In America, again, it's an American coin they had. So these are very interesting findings that completely contradict modern perspectives. And here we see this story, how this king appears from the arms of his father, Vena. But ultimately, what we want to say is that matter doesn't produce life. Matter is not the source of life. Matter is the byproduct of consciousness. So, if you take some chemicals and if you mix them, you'll not be able to produce consciousness. So how did they produce Prithu? You know, by taking from the arm of Vena some of his substance there, and how can they produce? Actually, what happened is that this partial incarnation of the Lord, Prithu, appeared in the family of Vena to continue the dynasty. And in that way, the Dharma can be protected, re-established and protected, and then in that way the dynasty can continue. So that was the purpose of Prithu appearing in this family of Maharaj Vena. So what Prithu did is that he, first of all, subjugated all the thieves and criminals that were there, established Dharma. Then the earth, due to the abuse of Vena, the earth had decreased her produce. People are starving because the sacrifices were not there as well. So there was some huge effect within short time in the rule of King Vena. So Prithu had to revive the vitality of the planet Earth and the relationship between humanity and the Earth, which was broken due to the exploitation of Vena. And it's explained here in the fourth canto that Prithu had to chase the Earth for some time, and she was in the form of a cow trying to escape from him, because she thought, if I'm in the form of a cow, he won't harm me because he's a Maharaj is a king. The king must protect the cow. But Prithu chastised Bhumi Devi to subjugate her again and put her under his rulership. And it's explained in the Bhagavatam at the end of the part 1 of 4th canto that then after this happened, Prithu started to treat the earth as his own daughter. You see. So this again shows the consciousness of a real king. He is seeing himself as the servant. So although he wanted to utilize the resources of the earth, he treated Bhumi as his daughter, which means he became her servant. And didn't uselessly exploit Bhumi Devi. So these are very complex themes to discuss, and not so easy to discuss, because from an external point of view it may look like some fantasy stories, the Prithu chasing the earth in the form of a cow, you know, and him coming of the body of Maharaj Venu, you know, the dead body of Venu. They squeezed the arm, took some of the DNA, and they produced, you know, the these children from him. So it may look like very, very like speculations, like stories composed by some bygone era human beings who had no idea what's going on, and they just were speculating in their own way. But if we follow the teachings of Bhagavad Gita, then we understand that all these things are possible, because first of all, there is multidimensional reality, which we don't understand. Now, recently, a scientist started to double up with this, with science. There is a new theory now called biocentricity by Roberto Lanza, who proposes there is multidimensional reality, and also his proposition is that perhaps consciousness is the origin for matter. Consciousness is the source of matter, not the other way around. So he's considered to be scientist number 3 in most influential scientists in the world, according to New York Times. But he may be considered scientist number 3, but when he came with this theory, now we don't know how quickly his ranking will fall, because people will not be so eager to accept such metaphysical theories and perspectives on life. They just want to make everything crude and gross. Everything is just matter. You mix chemicals and then consciousness is produced. So someone comes up with another theory, he may be very highly rated. Immediately they will make him an outcast. So I don't know what will happen to this person. It's recently that this thing came out. So, but the scientific world is beginning to divide into two sides. The one is supporting the intelligent design movement, and one is, of course, supporting neo-Darwinism. And there is like wars about what, you know, should be taught in schools. But of course, the intelligent design movement, they say that, you know, we don't say that evolution should not be taught in schools, but we say that it should not be the only theory that is given to the students. Plausible theory, because it's not the only plausible theory. Intelligent design is also a scientific theory, it's not a religious theory. Because the conclusion of intelligent design is not derived from the Bible or from the Bhagavatam or something. They just studied the cell, and they saw that in the cell there is nanotechnology, nano machines, small machines extremely small, that you have to look with extremely powerful microscope to see that these small entities that are far smaller than the power of human eye to perceive, they are so finely designed that they function in absolute harmony with other machines that are inside the cell, and they make the cell functional, and then when the cell is functional, then the whole body becomes complemented. So they say that this cannot really evolve because this machine, because they, it's such a complex thing, and there is no such a law in the universe that can account for such complex machines to be produced by itself. Even for any object to be produced by itself. Like, for example, this stand here for the verse, it can be probably broken into 10 parts. We can break it into 10 and put it, spread it around the temple room. What law in the universe will be there? Is there such a law in the universe which will account for putting all these different parts together at the same time to produce this? Yes, there is such a law. The human being will come and do it. But not by itself. You see. So, therefore, this is just a scientific fact that, you know, every complex system, there must be some designer behind it. So why only you should teach evolution? All right, we don't mind you teach evolution as a theory, but why also don't involve the intelligent design in the schools and give the alternative to the people to choose what they want to believe? They are forcing them now into something. So from this purport of Srila Prabhupada, we understand that the king was always subservient to the brahmanas, to the guardians of society. The brahmanas knew what's the goal. They were the leaders. Leader means someone who leads you somewhere. Leading. And the brahmans, their vision was transcendental. They would see the goal of life to be reconnection with the supreme source of everything. And naturally they were detached from the material world. They were detached from being controlled, because if you're detached from the material world, you can't be controlled by mundane things. Therefore, Prabhupada says, such brahmanas were not paid servants to the king. Therefore, they had the strength to dictate to the king on the principles of scriptures. This system continued even up to the time of Maharaj Chandragupta, and the brahmana Chanakya was his unpaid prime minister. So the Brahmins were pure up to that time, and after this time there was degradation. The more Kali Yuga progressed, it came with the offense of the boy who offended Parikshit. What was his name? Someone? Shingi. He offended Parikshit, and then from there all the Brahmanas were cursed to lose their brahminical status. So in that way, the leadership, the head of society, was dismantled. And gradually, the kings did not have the proper counsel. Brahmanas became attached to material opulence, to money, power. Then they started to become controlled by the kshatriyas, who have lesser consciousness. They were concerned about this material world only, the comfort in the material world. And then the kshatriyas became weak. Due to their impious deeds, they became so weak that the Vaishyas overpowered them. And the Shudras. Arjuna, for example, when Krishna left the planet, Arjuna was defeated by some cowherd men. They defeated him. He was the most powerful warrior. He defeated Indra and Shiva. He fought. So some cowherd villagers, they just overpowered him. So these are some very deep subjects that we need to think about. It's not some stories for entertaining ourselves or look superficially at Yeah, King Vena, Maharaj Prithu, we say something to each other and then we go take prasadam. No, we have to think very deeply. What is this? What is this? You know, how can we actually understand this? You know. So, and Prabhupada says here, long life, obedience, good reputation, righteousness, prospects of being promoted to higher planets, blessings of great personalities are all vanquished simply by the disobedience of a great soul. So this was Vena. It's explained because of this disobedience, he was killed. He went to hell and he took birth as the son of Mlecha and he was sick from leprosy. So his son, Prithu, understood where his father was in his next incarnation, next reincarnation. And he went and he delivered him from this, took him to Kurukshetra, Dharmakshetra, Kurukshetra, Samaveta Yuyutsava. So he purified him there, relieved him from all the sufferings. And this is a perfect son. Putra means one who delivers his father from hell. You see. So, along with establishing Dharma on the planet, Prithu Maharaj also delivered his father, protected the citizens, and in that way, this was his function, specific function. He came to establish Dharma. He was a partial incarnation of the Lord. And later in the second part of Srimad Bhagavatam, we can see different lilas that he performed, such as offering the 100 Ashwamedha sacrifices, then Indra coming to steal from him because being afraid that he will be displaced. And the sweetest of all is the other day when I gave the class, I was speaking about the four Kumaras being the knowledge incarnation of the Lord. And then I forgot who the four Kumaras spoke to in the Bhagavatam, but then later on I realized it's to Prithu. They preach to Prithu. So even although he is Krishna, incarnation of the Lord, he was so humble that he took the counsel of the pure devotees in the face of the four Kumaras. And he took the position of servant. So Prithu Maharaj was qualified to be a leader because he was free of envy. You see, he was obedient to the Brahmins, he was obedient to the Vaishnavas, although he was God himself. This is very interesting. He was in the mood of service. And he had the welfare of everyone in mind. Therefore, he protected Dharma, he established Dharma, he reinforced Dharma. This is not an ordinary feat, because the human body is specifically designed or given to those who are deserving to go back to Godhead. Therefore, if Dharma is not there, then this whole world is useless. This human form is useless. Therefore, the Lord comes again and again. Yada yada hi dharma syagla nirbhavati bharata abhyutana madatmanam tadatmanam srijami aham. Whenever there is decline of religious practice and rise of irreligion, at that time I descend myself. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki Ananti Kori Vaishnava Vrinda ki Gaur Premanandi. Any comments or questions? I know I took a little longer time, but I just couldn't superficially look at this. Yes? Yes. When Krishna left the planet, he became disempowered. Yeah, that's how Kali Yuga entered. Because if there is very strong Kshatriyas, then Kali Yuga cannot enter. It's an accumulated reaction. Basically, when the living entities are in this world, they're constantly producing sinful activities, and then it accumulates. And then the reaction hits as Kali Yuga. Kali Yuga is the accumulated sinful reactions of all other ages. They can keep Kali Yuga away. Just like in this temple, Kali Yuga is kept away by the devotees who are in charge. How? Four regulative principles, chanting 16 rounds, worshipping the deity, offering prasadam, feeding, preaching the glories of Krishna. This is not Kali Yuga. We are in Kali Yuga, but we are in the golden age, actually, just being in this temple. It's true. Yes?
Thank you for a very nice lecture. The power of mudra we can see, the Brahmana direction of power, but now they are lucky because they are not so biased.
Yes.
For the, today, very official day also, Vasant Panchami, and appearance of Raghunath Das Goswami.
Raghunath Das Goswami. You should say, you are an expert of all the sadhus. Well, Raghunath Das Goswami was one of the most intimate associates. Please come. Most intimate associates of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He, from very young, he was attracted to Lord Chaitanya's movement. He tried to run away from his house. But his father would send the guards to capture him and bring him back. So two times they brought him back like this. So then they thought, how can we actually bind him? But father was a very rich businessman. Very wealthy, multimillionaire. Yeah. So how can we keep our son? Otherwise our business will be spoiled if he runs away to become a sadhu, you know. So he was a devotee, his father, but still he was thinking that my son should serve the business and perform karma yoga. So he was not interested in him running to join Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So what happened is the father and the mother counseled one another and they decided we should get the most beautiful girl and we should marry him. And in that way, that girl will keep him. You know. So then they married him for that girl. They said she was like the goddess of fortune. So beautiful lady. Pious. Subservient to him. Ready to do anything for him, you know. But he still ran away. So they caught him again. So the father was thinking we should chain him up, you know. And the mother was saying we couldn't chain him up with this young girl. You're saying this chain will keep him. Not possible. He'll break the chain and you'll run away somehow. So they still kept guards to be around him. But somehow other one night he just ran away through the jungle, through the forest. And he went to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Mahaprabhu first told him, stay at home, you know, before this time, before the last time he ran away. Mahaprabhu also encouraged him, stay at home and pretend that you're a materialist, that you're performing your materialistic duties. At the same time, you should think of your paramour all the time, just like a wife that is fallen in love with paramour. She's doing her duties very nicely, but all the time her mind is on her lover. Mahaprabhu used this cryptic example. So he managed for some time to stay in the family, but he couldn't for long. So he was responsible for this Panihati festival. He was punished, I believe, by Lord Nityananda because he went first to Lord Chaitanya. He offered obeisances and then Lord Nityananda got angry and he said, why are you going to him by circumventing me? You know, you have to come through me to go to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So he punished him. So your punishment is to feed all the Vaishnavas. He knew he is from a very wealthy family, so he engaged him in service. So in that way Raghunath fed the whole Vaishnav community at that time by the Ganga. They had a cheap rice festival, Panihati. It's a place called Panihati, Bengal, celebrating the name of this festival. And yeah, they had an amazing festival. And gradually, they say Lord Chaitanya appeared there and took also from the feast. And although he was invisible, those who had the eyes to see, they could see him. And then Nityananda Prabhu was feeding him. And then the prasadam that he was giving was disappearing. You know, Lord Chaitanya was taking the prasadam. So later on, Raghunath went to Puri to be close to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And he was extremely austere. So first of all, he would get money from his father, and then he will feed the Vaishnavas. Later, he's rejected this money. He started begging from different businessmen there in Puri for some chapati or something, just to survive. And then after that, he stood in front of Jagannath temple and he begged for something, whatever little prasad he'll get, and then he'll disappear. So Lord Chaitanya was observing all these different activities of Raghunath Das, and he was thinking, you know, my devotee is becoming more and more renounced, and I like this. After that, he felt like a prostitute standing there in front of the temple begging from people. So he went where the rejected rice from the Puri temple, whatever from the prasad was left over, they would throw it to the cows. And whatever the cows didn't eat, there was some rejected rice covered with dirt. So he would grab this rice, wash it with water and eat that. That was his eating. So Lord Chaitanya was asking, where is my devotee? I don't see him anymore in front of Puri when I go there, the temple, Jagannath Puri. So they said, no, your devotee is now taking this rice. So he went to see him, Mahaprabhu. And he told him, what prasadam do you have for me? And he was hiding that rice, dirty rice that he had gotten from the ground and washed it. He was hiding it away. And Mahaprabhu snatched it from him and he tasted it and he said, this is the best prasadam I've ever tasted in my whole life. Because he could feel that this is the devotion of Raghunath. He doesn't want to be controlled by the external energy. He wants to be completely under the Daivi Shakti. So he was not dependent on any external things. And Raghunath Das Goswami became very intimately connected with Lord Chaitanya. He observed his pastimes in Puri. And later on, when Lord Chaitanya disappeared, Raghunath Das, he provided the lilas for Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami to record in Chaitanya Charitamrita. So he became like the his historian, one of the historians of Lord Chaitanya, specifically during the time of Jagannath Puri. And he wrote many books as well. He lived at Radha Kund in Vrindavan. When Mahaprabhu departed, he went there and he lived at Radha Kund. And he wrote some books describing the lilas, most intimate lilas of Radha and Krishna. I believe he was called the Rasacharya, the Acharya of Rasa, Prayojana. He was teaching the fully blossomed love of God was displayed by Raghunath Das Goswami. So on this day of his appearance day. On this day of his appearance day, we should humbly beg for the mercy of Raghunath Das Goswami upon all of us and all the other devotees. We should learn to pray for others also, not just for ourselves. And to asking to bestow upon us a ray of pure love of Krishna in our heart. And by doing such a prayer with great sincerity to Raghunath Das Goswami, certainly he will bestow our desire, because the pure Vaishnavas, they are kalpa vrikshas, they fulfill all your desires. So if you have a pure desire, it will be fulfilled. If it is not coming from the heart, maybe it will not come. But if you really, really humbly begging for the mercy, certainly you will be blessed. So on these days, it is very important that we remember these great personalities and we glorify them. Hare Krishna. Raghunath Das Goswami ki. Granturaj Chimad Bhagavatam ki. Srila Prabhupada ki. Ananti Gauri Vaishnava Vrinda ki. Gaura Premanande.